Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Steve Haywood. We're once again here at Tennessee ASEP at their annual meeting here in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and a conversation today on advances in ED respiratory care and management. And I think everybody is aware over the last number of years that the carte blanche application of oxygen is not a great idea. We know that just like fluids, people need as much as they need and no more, and the potential detrimental effects. So let's talk about that and some of the methods and things that we need to consider in the emergency department. Some of the stuff that we've talked about before we started recording is some stuff I've heard about and been learning about recently over the last couple of years, and really being getting people the care and the level of oxygen and intervention that they need. So Dr. Haywood, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
So talk to us. What's the problem?
The key takeaway, I think in 30 seconds, the key takeaway, if you have a patient on a non-rebreather, you need to get them off of that as soon as possible. Non-rebreather is a great tool. You can deploy it rapidly. If a patient's hypoxic, you can get it set up within seconds. You can deliver them a lot of oxygen quickly, but it is a terrible long-term solution. Anytime you have a patient on a non-rebreather, you've got to get them off of that as soon as possible. Like you said, there's great evidence. You need as much oxygen as you need, but no more. Fantastic trial in 2016, published in JAMA, the oxygen ICU trial, looked at critically ill patients and how they responded to oxygen. They did their standard therapy, was just whatever we usually do, we're going to do. And the other group, they were really aggressive about keeping the FiO2s low. What's interesting is their difference in PaO2 wasn't that much. The standard group had a PaO2 of like 102, and the conservative group was only 87. So that's not a huge difference. But when you look at their outcomes, the mortality difference, 20% of the patients died in the standard group versus like 11.6 in the conservative group. So a minimal PaO2 difference, but a huge mortality difference that was statistically significant, had a p-value of 0.01. And so that's really showed us even small differences in oxygenation have mortality benefit. A non-rebreather can kill your patient if you leave that on there long term.
Well, and you think about it. From the lay public, you need oxygen. Oxygen is good. But from a professional, from a physician standpoint, emergency medicine, there's so much more that goes into it, that balance and oxygenation. And you were saying just under that little over 100 mark, you know, I mean, we're all used to having these folks come in and getting a lab, finding out their PO2s in the 200s, 300s, or higher. And we know the detrimental effects. We know, especially when it comes to our cardiac and neurologic patients, the potential of getting that oxygen level too high is going to have that downstream effect. You talked about that one right there, which is about a 40% absolute death reduction. Just kind of run it through my head real quick. And that's something to consider, getting them off of that. So what are the things, what do we need to look at? So walk me through this evaluation as somebody comes to the emergency department. We know that, you know, typically they're going to come in, they're going to have the non-rebreather on. A lot of times now they're going to be CPAP as well from the EMS standpoint. That airway evaluation and really gauging where we go.
Yeah, so here's what I do clinically. That patient rolls in with a non-rebreather on, especially if they're sat 99, 100%. I just pull it off and put them on a regular cannula and put them on 6 liters. And I'd say a majority of the time, their O2 sat stays above 90 on that regular 6-liter nasal cannula. EMS, you know, they get the patients here quickly. They stabilize quickly. They see a low sat. They throw an underbreather on and get them here. A lot of times you can just get by with a regular cannula, get that FiO2 down quickly. And then if that's not cutting it, you know, I love the high-flow nasal cannula. You know, there's certain pathologies we know that BiPAP has a great mortality benefit, namely like COPD, heart failure. That's obvious. I just go to BiPAP. But if they're not cutting it on a regular nasal cannula and they need that non-rebreather, I love the high-flow nasal cannula because I can dial in that FiO2. I can give them 100% if they need it, or I can back it to 60%, 40%. I can dial in the exact FiO2 they need, give them as much oxygen as they need, but no more. It's a great tool that I utilize.
There's been good research that's come out over the last couple of years with regard to the high-flow nasal cannula with regard to COPD, asthma, reactive, no, I was thinking bronchiolitis. Mm-hmm. I about said reactive airway disease again, but bronchiolitis and areas like that. So talk about that. How is it, you know, something that not a lot of us are using in most, especially community-based emergency departments, kind of the methodology, the idea, how it's really going to really get us another step or another tool for that management of the airway patient?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing we talked about is you can dial in an FiO2, so you can limit their oxygen exposure. The easy money pathologies, you mentioned bronchiolitis in kids. They do fantastic on a high-flow nasal cannula. That it's been deployed on that patient population for close to 20 years now. So that's, if you're not doing that, if you've got a really sick bronchiolitis kid, you're definitely behind the times. And then in the adult world, high-flow nasal cannula really came into its own in 2015 with publication of the Florali trial. It looked at pure hypoxic respiratory failure, excluded heart failure, excluded COPD. They were left with some pulmonary fibrosis, but mostly it was pneumonia patients. And the prospective randomized control, these are pretty sick folks coming in pretty bad respiratory distress, randomized them to non-invasive positive pressure ventilation versus high-flow cannula. And the high-flow group had a decreased 90-day mortality rate.
Mm-hmm.
So these patients, your bronchiolitics and then your pneumonia patients, you need to get them on high-flow over non-invasive. There is a mortality benefit there. Some of the other disease pathologies, you mentioned COPD. There's some great evidence coming out right now. The DOSHI trial that was published last year showed that the high-flow cannula did decrease the CO2 levels in the same rate as a non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. I know the COPD arm of that is currently in PrEP, and I've seen those numbers, and they're even more impressive than the numbers as a whole. There is a ventilatory benefit of high-flow nasal cannula. We don't think about it, but it works clinically. You know, there's some great videos. You can see the exact pathophysiology, the mechanism that it works. Heart failure patients actually just had a paper just accepted for publication in the American Journal of EM, which is the heart failure subgroup from the DOSHI trial. And the problem with heart failure right now is that we just don't have a lot of data. Our study was by far the biggest one to date, and we had 42 patients total, 20 in one arm, 22 in the other. Our patients on high flow did well, but again, it's still small numbers. Like I say, I think the low-hanging fruit right now is pneumonia and bronchiolitis. Mm-hmm. You've got to get those on high-flow cannula.
One of the issues I think we see is, though, like my department, we have 10% peds. We're a community emergency department. And so the amount of bronchiolitis is relatively small for the for the technology. Even though the technology really comparatively is not that expensive, it's just having that available in a place that doesn't admit pediatrics and doesn't have a huge volume. So I think it's lag there, because I think it's still that setting where a lot of people assume, quote, we don't do kids, end quote, and which is not the case. Anybody and everybody, if you're in an emergency department, you're going to have some pediatric volume, of course, especially when people are trying to avoid the big tertiary care hospitals, the volumes and things associated with that. But you talk about compliance, you know, compliance, trying to get the kids, you know, they're not going to do a mask. And, you know, so we've got the old oxygen tubing inside the styrofoam cup method that everybody still does. And I was surprised to see with that research, the tolerability, how kids tolerate that high flow nasal cannula more versus some of the other modalities that we've used.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know Dr. Tift, who's the assistant medical director here at EMS Hamilton County, he's presenting a little while. A lot of EMS agencies are, especially pediatric transport teams, have a portable high-flow nasal cannula device that they're putting on their trucks, especially in the community setting. You know, if you've got a children's hospital close by, I'd say call their transport team, because they're going to have the cannula and they're going to be used to putting it on kids. Like you say, a shop where you see 10% peds, you're going to see a sick bronchiolitic rarely. And so to have the expertise, get the expertise there so that they can deploy it, I think is important.
Well, even their research that came out with the high-flow nasal cannula in pediatrics with bronchiolitis, the number, you know, it's not like, okay, they're going to be admitted, now we use it. The sheer number that it was able to keep out of the hospital was rather impressive. And, you know, we're looking for bronchiolitis. Everything we've heard and everything we've seen over the last number of years is that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. And we do it because, you know, just like everything else in medicine, we have to feel like we have to do something.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, the whole idea with a parent of saying, well, there's nothing I can do. Let's stare at each other and see if you need to be admitted or not. You know, this is, we finally have something, or we have something that, especially with the newer technologies and newer delivery methods and machines out there for the high flow, you know, the nasal cannula, it makes it something where, especially bronchiolitis, we can actually make a difference and get people out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I say, bronchiolitis, pneumonia, you need to get those patients on high flow. Other disease pathologies, it's a great, if they can't tolerate the BiPAP, if it's contraindicated, I use it. I go to BiPAP first. It's proven. In COPD, heart failure, it's proven. But, you know, a lot of patients can't tolerate it. And so, absolutely, your bronchiolytics, your pneumonia patients, high flow nasal cannula does a great job facilitating secretion clearance, improving secretion clearance. So at a minimum, you need to be doing it on those patients every time. And then, like you say, it's another tool in your tool belt. When that COPD patient comes in and freaks out when you put that mask on them, rather than snowing them with benzos and risking intubation, hey, let's try it. Let's try this high flow nasal cannula. See if they can tolerate that and get them through until all that beta agonism kicks in.
And I see them with the heart failure patient, you know, getting a little BiPAP and, you know, bridging them within an hour or two. They're through that acute crisis, especially the flash pulmonary edema.
Yeah.
And then transitioning to something that is not as cumbersome to many patients. Many patients, they have significant apprehension and anxiety related to having that mask on their face. And so can we... It's a great next step for those that are improving, but also maybe something that, if this is not going to work in preventing that intubation, which we know as soon as we put down that definitive airway, you know, the morbidity and mortality for our patients goes up, and you know the chances of them having a complication, prolonged stay, and something, a bad outcome, go up significantly. And it's unfortunately something that we have to do on occasion for our patients. But I think in emergency medicine, we are evolving in terms of our mindset that the only airway is not necessarily a definitive airway in terms of an endotracheal tube. But, you know, we want to try to do everything we can to prevent that step. And, of course, residents, they don't want to hear that. They want to get their airways knocked out. But for you and I now in a community setting or a practice setting as an attending physician, you really are looking at ways to get the patient turned around without that significant intervention and risk.
Yeah. I think there was an interesting finding in the Doshi trial that was published last year in Annals of Emergency Medicine. So their primary endpoints, they had no statistical difference, but when you look at the raw numbers, the non-invasive group was actually intubated quite more frequently than the high-flow group. However, when you look at all-cause failure, so crossovers, the high-flow group, just the raw numbers are pretty noticeably higher. And so I think what happened in that study was people would randomize to the high-flow nasal cannula group, and we all have that set timer in our brains as physicians. I'm going to give this 15 minutes. I'm going to give this 20 minutes. If they're not turning around, I need to escalate. So when they were starting the high-flow group, I think they thought of non-invasive as an escalation. They'd give them that 15, 20 minutes, and then they would escalate. I think that's why your crossover rate was noticeably higher. But then they'd give them another 15, 20 minutes on the BiPAP. So I don't know that the intubation rate was lower in the high flow group because it's better, or just we gave those patients more time. You know, we gave them longer than we usually did. We held off on intubation. We treated their COPD. We treated their heart failure. Because like you say, you intubate those folks, and the minute that plastic goes through vocal cords, your mortality goes up.
Well, yeah. I mean, you start popping lungs, causing the barotrauma and all that jazz as well. And many times I think looking at it, you know, really for heart failure and for COPD, we really need about 30 minutes to an hour to really kind of get most of them turned around, at least get them to where they're feeling better. Once we get our medications on board and other techniques to kind of get that ventilation back going or shift fluid, whatever it may be, whichever process you're dealing with. And it's that, it seems like with heart failure, other than those that are just going to get fatigued. Well, COPD is the same. Fatigued over time to the point that, you know, they're just going to wear out and eventually lose that respiratory drive to be adequate. Most of them we can get turned around pretty quickly to the point that then we don't need as much. So if we can bridge that initial evaluation period, if you want to call it the golden hour, that's fine. You can do whatever you want. But, you know, if you want to do that and bridge, then that's, you know, maybe we can prevent invasive procedures, keep people out of the ICU. Even in some cases, many cases, especially with our heart failure push, is keep them out of the hospital altogether. And get them home where they're more comfortable and free up more beds in our hospital and our emergency department for the next patient that's going to come.
Yeah. You know, I had a great case last year. I had a patient rolled in and looked like death when she rolled in. She looked like she needed an airway immediately. And my charge nurse came up to me and told me that she had that the nurse had already arranged a bed in MICU for her and I needed to just admit her, which kind of made me mad because, you know, I want to be the doctor. And so we went in there. I mean, this lady has distended neck veins. She's got rails. We put the ultrasound on her. B-lines in the apex of the lungs, clearly fluid overload. She's got a fistula in her arm. You ask her when she dialyzed. She missed a couple sessions. So we started a really high-dose nitro drip on her. We did some positive pressure with her through a mask. Really, the nitro drip turned her around, got the BiPAP off. I called nephrology and sent her straight to dialysis. They weaned the nitro drip as they dialyzed her and discharged her. And this is a patient that rolled in, and everyone who looked at her said intubate her, send her to the ICU. But fortunately, you know, we can be physicians. And like you say, with these new modalities we have, we can tune these patients up and sometimes change it from an ICU patient to a discharge patient.
And that's the paradigm shift, is the way that the whole saying, yeah, it's the way we've always done it kind of mindset. The patient comes in looking like this is what happens. And we can prevent that in many cases now with a tearing down, you know, these walls in the hospital of saying this is the way it has to happen, as opposed to exactly what you did, which is a non-invasive type airway management followed by medications, followed by the real solution, which is dialysis for that patient, which would have been delayed even further if you would have intubated and sent the patient to the ICU.
Absolutely.
And then the potential of barotrauma, of hemodynamic instability, you know, in that patient as well. I had a patient just a couple of weeks ago that came in, a little minor heart failure, valvular disorder, flash pulmonary edema, and, you know, coming in, initial numbers are in the 60s, and I'm like, well, just don't look at the numbers. For one, I know that's not accurate because he's awake and talking, but, you know, let's manage this. You know, and people are bringing in airway supplies and bringing intubation boxes and respirator. Listen, let's get our nitro, let's get our BiPAP, let's get all of this going. And, you know, I admitted him to the ICU just because of something that never happened to him before. But at the same time, you know, honestly, within a couple hours, probably could have gone to the floor and had a, you know, minor intervention or evaluation in a much less stressful situation. But, you know, it's not, that's where the last 15 years of physicians, 10 to 15 years of physicians have started pulling away from that, jumping for the plastic. You know, and thankfully, I think that's a great evolution of our practice, is the fact that we are more critically evaluating the airway and bridging and trying to get them turned around, as opposed to an easy answer, the easy button, as you say. So, you know, those are, you know, two good examples of a little bit, you know, thinking a little bit deeper, getting into the weeds, figuring out what our modalities are, and then assess, reassess. And in most cases, they're going to turn that corner.
Absolutely. And I think it demonstrates the value of having a residency-trained, board-certified emergency medicine physician. Because rather than just following pattern recognition, we can treat people. We can downgrade what they need. We can save a lot of resources on the back end by providing effective treatment up front. And it's value added to the system. You know, it's going to cut costs downstream quite a bit. So again, makes me proud to be a ER doc.
Well, and it shows the importance of the type of training that we do. You know, those 3 or 4 years of emergency medicine residency training just isn't about, you know, learning how to treat and street or, you know, or bringing them in the hospital. It's really more about, you know, learning the little nuances and digging deep and really kind of using everything at our disposal. That, you know, I always like to refer the ER physicians as the MacGyvers of the hospital. Make it work.
Absolutely.
Figure out how it works. I don't have the exact tool. I don't have the exact, but we'll figure this thing
out.
And, you know, now that we are getting a lot of tools, you know, whether you're talking about the high-flow nasal cannula, talking about ultrasounds, things like that, you know, you're really starting to see the practice of emergency medicine flourish because we're getting the tools that are really allowing for the expression of our training and abilities, as opposed to in the past where it's just kind of gap and then consult the person who has the tools. You know, the new thing that we just brought into the emergency department for us is the ultrasound guided blocks for hip fractures and for wrist fractures in order for opioid sparing and pain management and safety for our patients, especially our elderly patients. I mentioned we only have 10% peds, but we have, it seems like 110% elderly patients over 85 and, you know, trying to be doing everything we can to help protect them. And that's really that evolution of emergency medicine coming to fruition as we bring in more techniques and tools. And it's going to be a bigger learning curve moving forward with the more stuff we do. But, you know, it's really what our patients need.
I think to bring this full circle kind of back to where we started, a lot of people think that what we do in the ER doesn't matter. Just get them up to the ICU, let the ICU doctors figure it out. And it's fine. Just leave them on the non-rebreather when they're in the ER. They'll get to the ICU and they'll figure it out. There was a great study looking at hyperoxia published in Critical Care Medicine in 2018. It was looking at ventilated patients, so not necessarily, you know, the patients we're talking about right now, but ventilated patients. It only looked at their initial PaO2, so that first blood gas we got in the ER. And, I mean, there was a very, very clear association with hyperoxia and death. You know, yes, long-term hyperoxia is bad, but even that one elevated PaO2 is going to have increased mortality. What we do in the ER matters. Doing good conservative oxygen management in the ER matters, and it changes the patient's outcome.
It's almost like the one low blood pressure and trauma is a negative outcome predictor.
Absolutely,
it's
yeah.
The one elevated PaO2 is a detriment as well. And
absolutely.
That's that key of looking at. We want that 92 to 96, 98%, but you know, not getting above that, you know, 98% for the standard management of our patients.
Yeah.
And that's hard. And the emergency physician has to lead that because so many in the emergency department, now the other staff and support, you know, they don't know these things. They don't know these numbers and the importance of balance as opposed to just, you know, putting out a campfire with a fire hydrant.
Yeah.
Which was our approach to oxygen in the past. It's just overwhelm it, and that must be good. And we're learning now that's not the case. It's not necessarily a good thing. More oxygen is not better.
Absolutely.
Exactly what we need to know more.
Absolutely.
Any other take-home points with regard to the advances in ER respiratory management?
So, I mean, we've covered a lot talking right now. I think the biggest take-home, and we've been harping on it constantly, is get those non-rebreathers off your patients. It's a great tool. It deploys quickly, gives you a lot of oxygen. But as soon as you see that non-rebreather on a patient, find a way to get them to something else. I love the high-flow nasal cannula because it's easy to titrate the FiO2. But, yeah, oxygen's a drug. If you use it inappropriately, it's going to kill your patients.
And we're talking about a different technology because when you just say high-flow nasal cannula, we're not just cranking up the wall.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
We're talking about an actual system. And talk about some of the differences in that system versus me just manually managing the tree on the wall, which is kind of like managing your IV fluids via how many drops are coming down.
Right. And, you know, we know occasionally we'll put a cannula, like for intubation, we'll put a cannula on a patient, just put it to the wall and crank it up for a few minutes. The problem with that is a dry gas coming out of the wall. There's no humidity whatsoever. It's actually cool. It's not even room temperature. And when you look at the effect that has on your respiratory epithelium, it kills it. It damages the respiratory epithelium, those cilia that are designed to sweep that mucus out. And I think that's why the high-flow nasal cannula devices that heat and humidify have been so beneficial for bronchiolitis, have been so beneficial for pneumonia patients, is because they facilitate that secretion clearance. These devices, again, they showed up in the late 90s, so it's not a new technology. It's been around 20 years, but it can heat, it can humidify gas, and it provides that high flow through your nose. And if you've never tried it before, 40 liters per minute of gas up your nose sounds horrible. But really, when you try out the devices, and if you go to a conference, usually they have some cannulas. They'll let you try out, feel what it feels like. It's comfortable. It really is. It feels fine. We're not talking about putting a cannula to the wall and cranking it up to flush rate. We're very much talking about a device that will heat, that will humidify gas, will allow you to dial in a precise FiO2.
We all know that the expansion of a gas dissipates heat and cold. So, I mean, you're going to be that the oxygen that we're using, not only are many of them outside anyway, especially this time of year when it's this cold, but we've all seen it. Those oxygen, the large oxygen storage units outside hospitals covered in ice.
Yeah.
And that's the air you're getting. And it is incredibly dry and incredibly damaging. And that's the big difference between the wall oxygen supply. We've known we've done that. We've heated and conditioned the air, in our vents and our BiPAPs and everything like that. But nasal cannula, and that's the difference between these devices. And, you know, they may have been around for 20, 30 years, but, you know, I think we're finally reaching the cost point and technology point where they're accessible diffusely to emergency departments now.
Yeah. Well, and it was theoretical. The benefit's been theoretical. When you look at the literature that's come out in the last 5-10 years, there's a mortality benefit.
Mm-hmm.
It really does save lives. Having a high flow nasal cannula in your ER is going to mean more of your patients are going to walk out of the hospital.
And just for the sake of having, you know, a tool that actually works with bronchiolitis.
Oh,
and now we're not just doing things just to as part of the show.
Absolutely.
Giving patients a breathing treatment just because, well, maybe, you know, there's a 5% chance or whatever.
Buterol. Maybe some hypertonic.
Let's cuddle. Pat kiddo on the head. Let's watch some SpongeBob SquarePants, and hopefully you guys can go home in a little bit. How can folks get in touch with you if they want more information? Because this really is, you know, you're from, you did residency down here in Chattanooga, now up in Akron, Ohio, and clearly have a lot of information, education on the advances in airway management. And I think that's something that's huge for the current practicing emergency physician, our EMS colleagues, and across the board on the acute stabilization of airway-related issues.
Yeah, so I'll self-promote a little bit here. You can find me on Twitter at HeywoodVents. Additionally, I've got a website right now that I've got some collaborators on, 5minutevent.com. It's really geared more towards resident students developing the basics of ventilator management. We've got a great video on oxygenation with links to the studies we talked about today, in addition to some additional studies on hyperoxia. And then you'll find my contact information as well on 5minutevent.com. I've got my email address on there. And, I'd love to take any questions or comments anyone has.
5-Minute Vent, and you say that's geared towards a lot towards residents and students, but honestly, if we are all realistic, we're all students. If you're not a student, you're going to end up behind very shortly in your practice. And as emergency physicians, especially in the community setting, you need to make sure that, you know, you take advantage of all of these things, these new minds, the new technologies, the evolution in the way we manage our patients, because medicine, it's evolving at a ridiculously fast pace, and that's pace, and that's, you know, we have to keep up, and it's resources like yours that that can help us cut through a lot of the data and a lot of the information out there and get down to the points. That's my favorite thing in the world, is allowing somebody else to do the work and then just benefiting from it for my patients.
Absolutely.
So thanks a lot, Dr. Steve Heywood, talking to us today about advances in ED respiratory care. As for me, you can contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, at everydaymed on Twitter, and of course, our ASAP Frontline Facebook page, and then make sure you're subscribing to all the weekly podcasts so you can get other great information like we got here today. So until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.